the Sibelius, for me, is it's much darker. It's much more integrated between the instruments. There is a sense of greater layering of the textures. As performers, we've worked very hard on this piece. I think, as great as this piece is, I think there are difficulties with it because there's so much, like Brahms, there's so much counterpoint and harmonic elements in here that everything is interesting. And if you're not careful, it can kind of become a little bit of a very mixed up soup. So you have to really try to bring out the voices that are important. There's passages in the beginning with just lots of textural stuff where, as opposed to the Grieg, the violin may be soaring up very high. You don't have the first violin doing that in this piece. You've got right in the middle, everybody's in this kind of same texture, which is a fantastic writing, wonderful writing. You could compare the two pieces saying that this is much more complex, and maybe it is. It's just a whole different kind of style.
One thing that's interesting historically with this piece is that Sibelius had been diagnosed apparently wrongly, obviously wrongly, because he lived for many years after with throat cancer. There was a tumor, and it was diagnosed as being malignant, which it clearly wasn't, because he would not have lived into his 80s the way he did. But he was convinced at this time that he was going to die soon. And the Fourth Symphony and this piece, which are written around the same time, are really about that. And the intimate voices aspect, the words, voce intimae, which are written over these three chords that appear in the slow movement, no one knows exactly what he meant, but it's clearly some kind of call from the other world, I think. The Fourth Symphony is clearly probably his darkest piece, very, very strange, wonderful piece. This kind of writing that Larry talks about in the beginning of this, of the quartet, where everyone is low and things are moving around, but you know, nothing really brightens up, nothing really soars up to the top of the range of the instrument. You're sort of lost in a kind of fog or darkness. And Gene and I were in Finland many years ago in December, and I can tell you, if you've ever been way up north like that in December, where it's only a little bit light for a few hours and the sun just barely comes to the top of the trees on the horizon and then goes down again, this is sort of the feeling of this of the Fourth Symphony, a lot of it, and this, it's very dark, very depressing time. And it's why by the way the sauna is so popular, because they need the heat, you know, and to feel like, to pretend that they're sitting in warmth and in the sun for a few hours, otherwise you really go crazy. The Fifth Symphony, by the way, which starts in a similar way to this quartet, then finally opens up, because by that time he knows that he's going to live, and that there's this wonderful moment in the Fifth Symphony where the brass, you know, come in with these wonderful major chords, and it's like, you know, he's been given his life back. But in this piece, you don't get to that. The last movement is very exciting, but it never goes into a major key. You never feel, it does briefly, but you don't feel at the end that, even with something like Opus 131, Beethoven, his last big quartet, at the end, he writes these big C-sharp major chords, sort of with his fist up in the air, you know, in defiance, but with Sibelius, you never feel that he's going to rise above that.
I'd like to say that I'm intrigued by the opening of the whole quartet, and I think that maybe it has a key to some of the other mysteries in the piece. It begins with a phrase played by the first violin, a rather simple phrase, and then answered by the cello with exactly the same amount of time, and then answered by the cello with exactly the same duration. There is a feeling of a verse, of a line of poetry, and then the second line is sung by the cello. And the idea is extended once again in the first violin part, the same length, and then the cello comments upon that. So you have this back and forth, but it's really like the first stanza of a poem. And there is almost a feeling of rhyme, if one may speak about rhyme in musical phrases. But the basic building material here is stepwise motion, the first few notes that the violin plays, all stepwise. And then he starts to open up the intervals a little bit. But then it's significant that as we go into the allegro in the first movement, the upbeat going to the downbeat, well, that's the interval of a fourth, but then most of the material after that is scalar, it's stepwise. That seems to be one of his main concerns in this piece, because if we look at some of the other movements, like the beginning of the slow movement, we also see this stepwise intervallic language, the stepwise way of proceeding. The same thing in the beginning of the fourth movement with this heavy pounding kind of folk dance is almost entirely based on scale lines going up and down. And then later in the movement, when we have this very atmospheric triplet material played by the inner voices, well, that's also stepwise. It's kind of an embellished scale. The triplets provide the embellishments, always going to the lower neighbor. I think much of the material of the last movement is also scalar. So I think that this is one of his concerns on a purely musical level here, apart from whatever programmatic extra musical ideas or feelings may be expressed in the work. Sometimes he gets away from this stepwise idea. For example, in the middle of the first movement, a new feeling comes with the introduction of something in a major key, something sweeter, more optimistic than what we've had before. And perhaps significantly, it is not scalar. It is not proceeding by stepwise motion. Instead, we have skips of thirds and fourths. And generally, there's a more optimistic feeling here. Thank you. At the moment that he introduces this material, we're in A major. He brings this material through various different keys, but then the second movement takes that A major material as the basis for a completely different soundscape. And it's really based on the same material as the first movement, but we wouldn't know it because suddenly everything is animated, it's vivace, we're in a bright key of A major.
It's almost like in the first movement you feel trapped or claustrophobic, and so what I described with the darkness of the Finnish winters, but also his own personal darkness at this time, the music just can't quite escape itself. That's the feeling. And sometimes the measures go by where really nothing is happening, almost like Shostakovich, where you just feel this tension and wondering what's going to happen, and nothing really does, you know, but it creates tension anyway. I mean, slow movement is in F major, or at least it ends in F major, and I mean, it is basically in a major key. It always reminds me of some of the great late Beethoven string quartets, which have the slow movements also in major keys, but delve into the deepest, most profound emotions and elicit that from the listener. And I think that this movement comes as close to a late Beethoven slow movement as anything I can think of, you know, from this period. Chromatic lines, I think why chromaticism was so important in as music developed into the Romantic era, and then, from Schubert into Mahler, and then into Schoenberg, and then the chromaticism eventually leading to the 12-tone system. The reason that chromaticism becomes so important is that, first of all, it creates a pulling, it creates an emotional response of one note going just a half step above or below, or the harmony shifting slightly, pulls at us in a way, even when it modulates, say in the Nielsen, when it modulates from E flat minor to D major, we're talking about only a half step, and yet it's a huge step, because you're going from the darkest minor key to the brightest major key. It's very interesting how this works. The other aspect of chromaticism, which I think is what intrigued Schoenberg so much, is the fact that you start to lose your way with the tonality. Look what Wagner did in Tristan. You know, the Tristan motive, it's exactly what that's all about, is that we're not sure where we're going with it, and we don't find out until, you know, 4.5 hours later what's going to happen. In this slow movement, the most important, the most poignant parts of the melody are a half step above. I mean, you get to have, Gene gets to F in the second measure of the first theme, but arrives from an E natural to F and then back to E natural. So there's this half step up to the note of the key and then back down. And then we have a D flat that comes on the downbeat of the fifth measure, which is a half step above the dominant of F. You know, so you have this chromaticism sort of pulling at us throughout this movement.
Thank you.
And one other thing that he experiments with in this movement, which I think is wonderful, and it's very typical of Sibelius, is unison. And not just unison with all four instruments, but he will, after the statement of the first theme, he has the beginning in the A-flat major section, which is measure 15, you hear the two violins playing exactly the same notes, and for a certain kind of color. The Beatles used this much later in a lot of, I think it was George Martin's idea to put the two voices together and actually sing a whole song with John and Paul singing exactly the same, you know, and then breaking off into harmonies. But it creates an interesting color, and I think this is one of the first examples that I can think of. I also recommend that the listener experience the second, fourth, and fifth symphonies as a way of kind of getting context of this. Of course, it's always helpful to know something about the composer's life. And I mean, Sibelius was made this huge hero soon after this time. He was given this tremendous awards from Finland, given a house, given a piano, given money, and told to just go and enjoy himself, relax, and write great Finnish music. And from that point on, we have no works of Sibelius. The pressure apparently was too much. He began to drink very heavily. Every year there was to be the premiere of the Eighth Symphony, and every year the Eighth Symphony was withdrawn. This went on for years and years and years. He did compose, apparently, much music, including the Eighth Symphony, and on his deathbed asked his wife to promise to destroy all the music that he had written that had not been published. And unfortunately, she agreed and did that. We have no music from the last 30 years, which is probably the biggest tragedy. It would certainly be nice to be able to look at this music and make our own decision whether it was worthy or not. Mm-hmm. But as David said, this quartet comes between the fourth and fifth symphonies, I believe, and then he writes the sixth and seventh symphonies come soon after that, and then it stops. So this is a very important work. His only real mature work, other than the symphonies and the violin concerto, that have found its way into the mainstream repertoire.